Want to see something crazy? Look at that. Did y'all see that? There is some, but they're just chatting. Well, I'll try. Well, no, because I got it on this crazy thing. There is sound. Isn't that cool? Look at that. It's amazing. Yeah. That's what I was waiting for in the movie, like flat. In the propellers or something. No. Sadistic. That's just pretty cool. Anyways, that was something to get you going. All right. So, let's think about what we're doing here. Web page, right? Web page. You see these two other links that you can download right there, and we're going to go over those today a little bit. And then if you scroll on down, way down here, there's some other stuff down here. We're going to go through this pacing, but this is for people that aren't here so they can see where it is too. Okay. So I just wanted to show you that. We're going to come back to some of these other links here in a minute. Okay, so we left off with circulation. It's not as bad as endocrine, but endocrine's quite a bit, right? Oh yeah, we wanted to go over this quiz. Just to make sure we're all on the same page. So, some missed points here and there. Adds up quickly, I know. And it was short, you know, a week, right, to kind of really digest this. But what I wanted you to do is a little bit of scare tactics, because there's a lot of material in the endocrine, right? And if you don't know already, I've told some of you, you know, there's 6 10-point class assignments or activities that gives you the 60 points for class participation, pretty much. We'll make a 7th one, and you can drop the lowest one. Or if you missed it and you forgot we had a quiz that day and slipped in, okay, fine. So we'll go through and drop the lowest one as well. Hopefully that helps some of you, decreases some stress. But you got 2 more major exams coming up too, right? The final. And the final, remember, has some comprehensive part to it as well. And you got 2 hours. I won't make it all essay, but there'll be some, you know, fill in the blanks too. We can't, you know, torture you like the 3 hours that we had for the first exam.
Just to make sure, this test is just multiple choice, right?
This test is going to be multiple choice with maybe some short answers. Like, why did you choose B? Why did you choose that answer? But mostly I can't have too many of those. I mean, real short. Okay. Or like, here's a cascade. What's that tissue in between, for example? You know, things like that. Does that sound good?
Much of the clinical stuff do you need to know?
So the clinical stuff, remember, we don't have to know the drugs and things like that, but you should know what does hyperthyroid, what would that happen to the person? What would hypothyroid be? What would happen if you had too much cortisol, for example? Would you expect a lot of muscle mass, or would you expect a decreased muscle mass over a long period of time? Decreased muscle mass. What does cortisol do for your glucose level initially? Raises it, right? And so those kind of things, all right? And so let's go through this part. Oh, I can put it up on both so you can see it, I guess. And one of these questions a lot of people missed, too. Hypothalamic neurons. So the neurons in the hypothalamus, right, release into the capillaries. So what do they release into the capillaries from hypothalamic neurons? Is there, and so it could have, now what could be confusing is if we had releasing hormones here, right? If it was releasing hormones, just think of rewording this question. Releasing hormones, but taking out this one and putting like thyroid releasing hormone. Would that be the right answer? Right, because it's released from hypothalamic neurons into the bloodstream that then goes to the next tissue. But in this case, the only right answer that is coming directly out of the neurons is the posterior pituitary neurons that releases ADH, or vasopressin, and oxytocin. Okay, so this one might have been a little confusing for some, but if we go back to... And you pick different answers, I know. But we'll look at it. So, can you see this? Chorionic gonadotropin comes from the endometrial lining. It helps maintain the corpus luteum, right? So this is where we are. Remember the pregnancy test, corpus luteum? I mean, it's to maintain the corpus luteum, chorionic gonadotropin. Progesterone will be released from the... Progesterone and estrogen are released from the corpus luteum, right? Pardon? So they could be released from that, but where we're really keying in is the chorionic gonadotropin, okay, to maintain that during pregnancy. That was helpful. And I know this can be slightly confusing, you know, because all of them in some way could have some aspect. Remember some of these negative feedback issues as well. So I don't mean to make it confusing or tricky, but watch out for these types of questions where you might think that, you know, oh yeah, because I know that could actually stimulate it in some ways, but the key kind of things might be pregnancy. And on standardized, like if you're taking MCAT or dental exams, things like that, or even the nursing exams, they're going to give you some answers that are almost, you know, like that, but it's going to be the best answer. All right, so I don't mean to make tricky questions, but we can always go through these and, you know, if you're like on the border grade or something of 1 point, we'll probably give, you know, 1 point curve or more at the end of the class. So maybe, I'm not going to make a promise, but we'll see. So some people miss this. Modified sympathetic ganglion. Number of people put pars nervosa. That's not it. Or they put adrenal cortex. So a number of people miss this. But it's the adrenal medulla, right? And that releases epinephrine, norepinephrine. So adrenal medulla. And this one was possibly hypothyroidism. So your question is about, you know, clinical aspects. So hypothyroidism, you know, that raises your metabolism, keeps you going. So you wouldn't feel more hot. You're going to feel colder, right? Because your metabolism is down. If you're hypo, remember hypo is low thyroidism. So I'm always tired. We're probably all hypothyroid right now. We're always tired, right? And, you know, that you might feel cold. So this question could be changed up a little bit. I feel cold most of the time. I have no energy. You could just reword these kind of questions, right? So this is why when you make your note cards, kind of keep those general statements on the back about what those hormones do. Binds to receptors inside the cell. So remember we talked about peptides and steroids in soluble compounds that can go right through bilipid membrane. So just go through here and think about which ones are peptides. Luteinizing hormone, insulin, parathyroid hormone, antidiuretic hormone, if you want to do a process of elimination. So the only one left is the thyroid hormone. And we mentioned that can go right through all your cells in your body like steroids.
For those PowerPoints, I think you posted an endocrine problem.
Yes, so that was the question that she just had earlier. So, yes, for the clinical aspects, the general points, but not to memorize drugs, okay? But, you know, if you have too much ACTH, what might you expect? If your adrenal gland's not working, what might you expect? Adrenal medulla, adrenal cortex. If you had a tumor in your thyroid, what would you expect? Remember, tumors are usually overproducing, right?
I'm sorry to go back, but what did you say, luteinizing hormone?
The LH, that's FSH and LH from the anterior pituitary, luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone in the normal cycle. Remember those? So go back to these kind of little figures here, right? Okay. A question, Matt.
Yeah. So for that question, you said it was a peptide. So peptides cross...
Mm-hmm. They're going to bind to the receptor on the surface.
I thought that's interior.
So, inside the cell.
Yeah, so it would be inside the receptor.
No, the steroid, like steroid molecules can go through the bilipid membrane and bind to a receptor inside the cell.
Okay.
and so would thyroid hormones. So things that can go across the membrane steroids. And then bind to a receptor inside.
So steroids.
Steroids and thyroid.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So that's. No, peptides are on the cell surface. Okay, and then here, some of you missed this one. I was hoping nobody would miss it. But glucagon, remember glucagon stands for what? Alpha cells, okay? None of these others. Now, here's one that was actually missed by more than 50% of the class, actually. TRH, what does TRH stand for? The recent releasing hormones. So what does that releasing come from? Hypothalamus, right? And it works on the next target tissue, which is
anterior pituitary,
right? Not the thyroid directly, right? So releasing hormones, anterior pituitary, and then anterior pituitary, thyroid stimulating hormone to the thyroid, and thyroid T3, T4, you know, to the body, right? ACTH, so. Some people wrote on their quiz, they didn't know what ACTH stands for. You really got to know those kind of acronyms, these, you know, abbreviations. Standardized exams, too, won't spell it out for you. So really try to remember these. ADH, for example, are vasopressin. You got to know both names. I know it's a lot to remember, but ACTH stands for
adrenocorticotropic hormone.
So it works on the adrenal cortex, stimulates mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, right? We talked a little bit about this, and we talked about some of this a long time ago also, but and in case you didn't know the hormones, but you had heard about the problem, for better performance by a bike rider in Lance Armstrong, what is he? He's not trying to make more sperm production or anything else, right, for performance. I didn't mean that kind of performance. I meant biking performance, okay? Hand, hand, all right. So biking performance, erythropoietin. Erythropoietin does what? Stimulates red blood cells. So, and that makes more red blood cells, so you have more oxygen. This is the same thing about blood doping that you hear about with athletes. And because erythropoietin is a natural hormone, you know, when they get tested for hormone injections, they say, oh, it's a natural hormone, right? It's like testosterone. But the problem is, on one of the Tour de France's, that I think it was like 4 years ago, what was it, five people died on that Tour de France, and they found out that all of those people were actually injecting erythropoietin, blood-enhancing hormones. So what happened when they end up in the hospital? Their blood is so thick, it was so viscous, it couldn't actually go through their capillary beds, and clots formed, things like that. So really bad to do these kind of things, but, you know, they're kind of crazy with competition. So erythropoietin for stimulating red blood cells to increase your oxygen. So how could you do this naturally? What happens with U.S. athletes? Where do they train, a lot of them, the runners?
High altitude.
Right. So that's going to stimulate red blood cell production, right? So that's why they train up in Colorado, the training camp. So when they come back down to, say, a lower level, like when they went to Brazil, that was really good for them because their RBCs were up naturally from, you know, being at high altitude. So you can kind of think of these things. It's kind of interesting. We'll talk about some adaptations later on, but sometimes going to high altitude, anybody ever get sick when they went to high altitude? Get dizzy, right? Some of the people that have chronic mountain sickness, if you went up to high altitude and you stayed for a long time, like if you were going to go around Machu Picchu in Chile, right, and go see the ruins, they have really a dizzy spell and they get sick and very nauseous, so you have to come back down. Some people actually that have less sickness than mountain sickness actually do not increase their red blood cells. So it actually, increasing the red blood cells for a lot of people actually caused more mountain sickness. So some people that didn't raise their red blood cells or weren't so sensitive to it didn't seem to get the mountain sickness so much. So it's kind of interesting to put it all together. So somatomedins, this is the growth. These are the factors that stimulate growth from growth hormone. And then the growth hormone activates somatomedins to be released from the liver. And then that enhances your growth of your body. Somatomedins are also referred to, and we didn't talk about it too much, insulin-like hormones, because they can actually activate the cells and increase their growth too. So you might see those referred to as different levels. There's a relationship with the somatomedons, or insulin-like growth hormone, that is related with the pygmies in Africa, not having either the receptors for these or not making the somatomedons. So it's kind of interesting to think about if you didn't have them, what happens to you. So I get this one was probably the most confusing because maybe I should have put growth in here. That would have helped a little bit. But, you know, we'll balance it out on some extra questions on the exam so you have extra points that you can get for bonus points, okay? So hopefully that will balance some of these harder ones that we had. It was more or less to kind of get you going to, hey, I really got to know this stuff, right? Okay. So I agree that last one might have been a little bit much, right? Okay. I'm not trying to be vicious or anything. Okay, so let's keep going with circulatory, and then we have some things we want to cover about this. And you've had your EKG lab already, right? And you did your running, diving response. Diving response was kind of cool, wasn't it? Yes. Anybody's heart really slowed down a lot? No, not too bad. You're slow. Yeah. Some people, if you do this with little kids, they can really slow down quite a bit. So that's something to watch out for. You don't want to torture your little. Yes. Put it in your face. And you can imagine, you see those people jumping into ice water, like the ice plunge and things like that. You wonder, you've got to be careful with some of these things.
I read an article that said that like might be the cause of SIDS. It's the dive reflex.
That's cool. So she mentioned about SIDS. SIDS is really complex. It's sudden infant death syndrome, right? Because there's so many variables involved. Maybe this diving response is it. Some people said that almost all the kids that had SIDS, that died of SIDS, were wrapped really tight, or they overheated as well. So there seems to be all these different factors. In California, there's a law now that if a child dies of SIDS, they actually have to be looked at with a pathologist, and they actually can take a sample of that child to find out if they had a genetic predisposition. But why they check that out in California is a law to make sure no one smothered their child, basically, because some people do that kind of craziness. So there's lots of, you know, issues behind it as well. They claim it to be SIDS, but it wasn't, you know, things. So lots of interest in there, but by the time they get them to the hospital to check, they can't find out. There's a group up at Dartmouth in university that actually is focusing on understanding SIDS at a CO2 pH level to understand if those neurons aren't responding to the drop in pH or rising CO2, and they're not responding appropriately to breathe. And they're thinking some of that might actually be to the pH sensitivity, the CO2 sensitivity in the babies as well. And so that's kind of interesting to put it out there. So there seems to be a lot of interesting aspects. Okay, so let's continue with circulation. There's a lot in this chapter 2. And what's happening on Monday and Wednesday next week? We're going to the labs. Don't forget to go to the labs. You hear that? Labs. Okay. And then we're going to cover up, probably finish up the circulatory system too. Review this weekend. What are you doing? Downloading old exams, right? On the web page as well as in the test bank. Going through those and understanding or come with questions for Monday or Wednesday as well. We still got class on Tuesday. We'll try to go through this. But the labs will spend more time going over old exams. And if you're going to NCR, then that'll be recorded, or you can send emails about some of those ahead of time, but try to come to one of those other labs. And a few people I emailed about, if you didn't get those emails, you know you got to come chat with me. Some of you have conflicts with that test date and other things. You want to send me an email so we can arrange these things, all right? Okay, so planaria. Do you think it needs a circulatory system much? Very flat, simple animal, lives in the water pretty much, just single, very flat animal. No, because gas diffusion can go right across that skin, right? And so they don't really have a circulatory system. These animals are amazing. You can cut it up to like 103 pieces and they'll just regenerate. You can split their head, they'll regenerate the whole body again. Phenomenal little creatures in regeneration and repair mechanisms. And it's still used quite a bit to try to understand how it can do that, regenerate a whole nervous system again, too. Even other animals are quite interesting. Remember the leech that I brought in? These are quite interesting because the leech, just to see the variety, the leak, ventral nerve cord, so its nervous system on the ventral side runs along the ventral side, but it's inside of a blood sinus. Isn't that weird? The whole ventral nerve cord and the ganglion for each segment runs inside of a blood vessel. And then as the little rootlets come out, that stocking of the blood vessel attaches really tight to the nerve roots so the blood doesn't come out around the nerve roots. So it actually can pump blood one direction, pump it back, and then it goes off into capillary beds to work on these muscles. Very interesting, weird creature, the leech system. All right, so that's kind of neat. And it pumps blood one direction, can reverse it back the other direction. So, you know, peristaltic pumps. Kind of neat. So if we think about these pumping mechanisms, just that, you know, I think this is kind of general that you understand these general ideas. So flagella could work, you know, to get oxygenation on simple organisms. Muscle pumps like our leg, we actually use skeletal muscle to help move our fluid, but it's not the main pump. I mean, our heart is, right? But like we just mentioned with these moving waves, chambered, we're going to see some of these in a little bit. And then axillary hearts are pretty interesting too, because you can have axillary hearts, you know, like extra hearts in animals that we might not think about. We'll show you some pictures of that in a second. So skeletal muscle helps us to pump our blood, moving it, peristaltic like we just talked about. And then these chambered hearts, simple organisms that have chambers, but then, you know, we're going up to a chamber with our two ventricles and atria as well. So just that you see, like in some fish, they can actually have, we haven't talked about it yet, like the lymphatic system, but we'll get to it. But some animals, like the fish, actually has a lymphatic heart. They can actually pump lymph and to get it into the circulatory system. So you can imagine if a fish is swimming really fast in the water, where's the blood going to pool? Back in the back of the animal, right? So it actually has pumps in the lymphatic system, so the lymph or the extracellular fluid doesn't build up in the back of the heart and pumps it into the circulatory system. Just something interesting to think about. And then other critters, even insects, they can raise their body temperature by pumping blood through their thorax or cooling it off if they get too hot and just sit still, and it's for temperature regulation as well. But their wing movements actually help in circulating the blood as well. Just to kind of see, hey, there's lots of different ways these animals can keep blood circulating. And if we think about, I think it's coming up here, insects really do not use blood for oxygen delivery. They use a tracheal system. I know we didn't get to respiratory yet, but the trachea actually have tracheal processes that go right down into the skeletal muscle. And these tracheal processes, like our trachea, they can even branch right on over into the brain. So that's where you get gas exchange. So the blood in insects isn't really for gas exchange. It's to move nutrients and around those tissues, hormones. But for the gas exchange, it's usually through the tracheal system. So it's kind of interesting to think about these. We'll talk about our favorite animal in a little bit, crustaceans. And we talked about ostia, these holes that are in many arthropods, which are insects and crustaceans, right? Articulated legs, insects and crustaceans are arthropods. And then a little bit of the fish heart, two chambers. I can think of the fish. There's some of these little exceptions we'll talk about, but you know the main points. So the fish, an atrium and a ventricle. And if you look at these simpler vertebrates, if you will, and then more complex vertebrates, it's kind of just building up to, you know, pretty much the type of heart that we have, which is really quite interesting. So the atrium with a thin wall around it, but what is the purpose of, like, our atrium, our in these animals, nature? What do you think? What's the real purpose for this? I mean, why do we have two atria here? What do they really do? Are they pumping blood throughout your whole body?
The lungs. The lungs take the oxygen.
Oh, yeah, let's see. Okay.
I was saying one side is it just pumps so the lungs get the blood oxygenating, and then the other side goes to throughout the whole body, so that's stronger.
Okay, so that's like the two sides, but the atria, the two that go into pump, where do the atria, what do they, where does the blood go next? Ventricle. So the ventricle is really the pump out, right? So what do you think the atria really do? What's their purpose? If your atria weren't working, would you be as efficient with your heart? function cardiac output? Probably not. So think of the atrium priming the pump. It's a reserve to pick up blood, but the atria contracting, pushing the blood in quickly, a whole bolus of it, right? So when the ventricle does contract, it is going to be full of blood. It's not just dripping in and then, you know, little pumps, right? So it's really to prime the main pump. But they have to pump to be able to prime that too. So they have some wall and some, you know, contraction, but usually the walls are thinner, right? They're not against a high pressure system. So they're just pumping blood into the ventricle to really allow that ventricle to fill up all the way, and then when it contracts, get that blood out. So you see the kind of the development of the system is the atria develop as the animals get bigger. Then you see like this two chamber, like in the fish, or bigger fish, actually the atria are a little bit bigger, right? So even throughout those animals to compare, it's quite interesting. So then the ventricle to really get that blood out, but you're against high resistance, right? So, you know, the whole circulatory system out here, smaller blood vessels. So if you pump, and you pump it out, you sure don't want it to be coming back, right? So valves to stop that blood from coming back. And you don't want the blood going back into the atrium. That would be inefficient, right? So now we start to see valves in these more complex systems as well. All right, so as we had mentioned, you know, right side is pumped to the lungs, left side out to the body generally, right? Oxygen-rich system. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this. Trick questions. Every year I usually put this on exam. If the right side ventricle is pumping out 5 liters per minute, what is the left ventricle pumping out? And we have like 1 liter per minute, 5 liters per minute, 10 liters per minute, 15 liters per minute, and what are you going to put? 5 liters per minute. It can't pump less or more, right? It has a closed system, right, in us, right? So it's got to pump the same amount. So don't get confused on that. And that has appeared on standardized exams, too. Like you might have seen that in your Kaplan study. So watch out for that. And we'll go through this whole circulatory system in mammals here in a little bit. So you should know how blood flows through the heart, like your heart, and that you can regulate that blood flow out in the periphery by what? Arterial constriction, right? The arterioles constrict. Our dilate are basically not have the constriction that shin by default dilates to like skeletal muscles. So if you start to exercise skeletal muscles, you get vasodilation, increased blood flow. But you might then vasoconstrict the arterial bed to your GI system because you don't need to be perfusing your GI system after a meal, right? But you need it if you're exercising. So a balance of this blood flow. Usually to the brain stays pretty constant, right? You don't need to increase and decrease, but you do get different blood flows to different parts of your brain depending on the energy that you use. So don't be too confused by that. That stays pretty much the same even with exercise. Okay, so, and you've just learned from your kidney lab, or your P lab, we call it, right, that your urine production is to help you to maintain your blood volume, blood pressure, salt balance. So let's go through some of this. And so you should know what comes in inferior, superior vena cava, right? Inferior, lower, superior, goes into the right atrium. Right atrium pumps, right? Goes across, what's that valve called right there? From the atrium to the right atrium to the right ventricle. You know, this aortic, AV valve, atrium ventricular valve, but there's another name for it on the right side. And if you're studying for MCAT type of exams, they're going to ask you that you're going to have to know that. So it's a tricuspid. How to remember the tricuspid on the AV? Boy Scout salute three for the guys. At least we've got something right now. Boy Scout, three fingers, right? Boy Scout, three fingers. Tricuspid, try, right side. Maybe you can remember that. Help you out. Okay, so then to the right ventricle, then out to the pulmonary artery, right? All arteries leave the heart. Veins return to the heart. So trick question. Pulmonary artery, oxygenated, highly oxygenated, or low oxygenation? Low oxygenation, but people miss that every year because you think artery, high oxygenation, right?
But this one is low oxygenation, not deoxygenated. Some tests say deoxygenated, and I might even say that on old exams. It's not really deoxygenated, it's just lower. You know, it's not really, the blood doesn't completely deoxygenate when it goes to the body. So it's just low oxygenation. So then it goes up the pulmonary artery through the lungs, returns from the lungs, splits that blood vessel, comes back to the left atrium, pulmonary vein. Now, is that going to be highly oxygenated or low oxygenation? High oxygenation, right? Because it's just finished coming from the lungs. And so people will miss that, but it's the most highly oxygenated part of your circulatory system. So then it goes into the left atrium to the left ventricle. What's that valve called from the left atrium to the left ventricle? Another AV valve, but it has a certain name. Yes, so the right side was a tricuspid, the left side is a bicuspid. And then it goes into the left ventricle, and the left ventricle then pumps. That's the major pumping. Remember that from the lab that we went over to the outreach center? Real thick tissue, because why? It has to pump against that high resistance, the whole systemic circulation, the very thick muscle, and then out the aortic valve, right? The aortic valve and the pulmonary artery valve are called, another name for those, semilunar valves, okay? So you might hear those on, you know, standardized exams as well. So do know the general flow through the circulatory system. What's kind of interesting here in this text that we're using, doesn't really go into it too much, there's so much that you can go into, but after the aortic valve right here, there's a blood vessel that comes off, just right behind these valves for the aorta. A little hole right there that you could see, and guess where that goes to? It starts the coronary circulation. It starts the circulation, the arterial circulation to the heart muscle. Remember, this muscle is really big. It has to, it can't just, it's not getting the oxygen from the blood going through this tissue. It has its own circulatory system, right? The coronary arteries. And so it's right after this valve, there's a hole here that then supplies the coronary circulation to the whole heart. Actually, the aorta is so thick of a tissue itself, the aortic valve, the aortic tissue, it's so thick, it actually has circulation to the aortic tissue as well. So you could go cross-sections through there, and you'll see a capillary bed in the aortic muscle, in the muscle of the aorta, because it's so thick. It can't get enough oxygen just by diffusion. So even the aorta has a circulatory system, okay? So it's really quite neat when you start to put it all together. So think about those small capillary beds to the aorta tissue, right? The aortic valve, not the valve, but the tube, if you will, the vessel, aortic vessel, and the coronary artery supply to the heart, and those little capillaries. Now, we showed you those hearts in the outreach center, right? If you remember those? Yes, kind of. Remember the fat that builds up on those? Think of those little vessels that if they build up with fat deposits, what's going to happen to the aortic muscle? If that fills up and doesn't get circulation, what's going to happen to the muscle? It's going to die, right? And if that dies, what happens to the aorta? You've got tissue that's dying, and you're pumping high pressure into it, and the muscle can't stay healthy, it dies, boom, right? You're going to have problems, right? Because the aorta tissue needs to stay healthy enough to handle that high pressure so that you can bust your aorta. So this can happen with people with atherosclerosis too, not just worrying about perfusing of the heart here, but you're also worrying about perfusing of the aorta and their fine little blood vessels to keep that tissue healthy. You've probably heard of people, it usually happens like in high school, the kids are playing basketball and then all of a sudden, or sports, and the kid dies just like that, and he's relatively healthy, but it's the first time they've really stressed themselves, like in athletic competitions, and they say an aortic aneurysm. And it might not be due to lipid buildup or anything like that. It's just their aorta was weak, and when they really pushed it, it opened up. And you can imagine if you had an aortic aneurysm that bust open, what's your chance of survival? Not much, right? So that's kind of it. Einstein supposedly had an aneurysm in his abdomen. That's one reason he died, they think. Kind of interesting. And he had this bleeding that went on. Didn't get it taken care of. We actually had a graduate student a number of years back that was working on a Saturday. He was upstairs, third floor, and he was feeling dizzy. And he walked over to the ER. When they got him in the ER, they realized he had an aortic aneurysm. He didn't last. He was on a machine. The parents really just said,
Well, he wouldn't want to live in a machine because he wasn't going to survive it, but the machine kept him going, so they had to pull the plug on him, too. But he had an aortic aneurysm, and only he walked on over to the ER, but it probably wouldn't have helped it, you know, if he called 911. So aortic aneurysms are something that's not great to have, right? But it could happen just with not even having the lipid buildup, but it's not strong enough to handle that increased stress that sometimes happens in hard competitions. I think there was a bike rider a number of years back in some competition that was in California, and that person was riding the bike and all of a sudden stopped and died, and they checked him out, had an aortic aneurysm too. You know, really high pressure, heart's really working hard, and busted that vessel. Okay, I know, not a good note, but you know, just keep your health up. All right, so we already talked about this, and we talked about the walls, and blood flow is really important. And if you start to build up those plaques in your blood vessel, what happens is that you can start little, it's not shown here really, but let's just pretend. It's the same idea. But this is a valve, right, to keep the blood flow and trying to keep this lamellar flow. But let's pretend this isn't the valve. Let's pretend this is a little plaque that built up right here in your blood vessel, right? If this is a little plaque, what happens to the blood that passes over that little bump and plaque? It makes a little eddy. And that little eddy can then cause the blood to stay there and actually clot. You can make these little clots after the plaque. And so it's turbulent flow, for one thing. It's not nice and laminar flow. But let's say there's a fat built up here. The blood's going to come across and then make like little eddies. It's going to cause a disruption in that laminar flow. And then this can actually lead to little micro clots. And then every once in a while they get big enough, and what's going to happen to them? They break off. And if they break off going to your brain, that's not good. Or they break off and going to your lungs, that's not good, right? So you think about, you know, this is why you want to make sure that lipids aren't building up in your blood vessels and to keep this. And also, if you have arrhythmias in your heart, for example, the heart's not beating right, it goes da-da-da-da-da, and it slows down, you know, slows down. The blood's going through and then it slows down. These people with arrhythmias are higher incidence of actually having blood clots also behind these valves in their normal circulation. So an arrhythmia can also cause these problems. If they're beating real quick and it kind of stops, what happens to the blood? It stasis, standing still. And that stasis then can lead to blood clots as well. So interesting to think about. These valves then really help in this picture. We're talking about valves. In this picture, then keeping that blood so it can't flow backwards. Really neat. When William Harvey, anybody ever kind of looked, there's some old really neat videos online about the history of circulation. Harvey was the, I forget which king in England, you know, the physician for the king, and he was a comparative guy, and he looked at and tried to understand the circulatory system, but he didn't want to go against the anatomists that were in Italy, and they had their own views and the way the blood circulated through the body. It was all hogwash. But he didn't want to go against them because they were the main anatomists at the time, and he would be discredited, and he was the king's physician, so he didn't want to be discredited. So it took him 10 years. Actually, he didn't come out with his studies that had been going on for 10 years, and he knew the real answers and the real anatomy for blood circulation. And he dissected dogs, all different kinds of animals, wrote lots of notes, and kept it all. But finally, he came out with his view of the circulatory system, and it changed the whole view. And then the Italian anatomists had to kind of, ooh, we've been wrong all these years. But they were believing these people that were really the main people that were working on anatomy at the time. And so what he actually showed on comparative studies is, like humans, we have these valves. Where do we have these? You know, in our legs, right? For the venous return, for example. So when blood's pooling in your legs and you move your leg and muscle, that blood goes up and then it doesn't go back down, right? So valves to keep the blood going this direction. But we're right standing up animals. Do we need valves in our head to keep blood going one direction? In our veins, right? Because we're standing up, right? Where's the blood going to go? Downward, unless we're living in space or something, right? So it's going to go down. But if you look at dogs and animals that have their head down, they've actually have valves in their veins in their head. So in animals like a giraffe that bends its head down, that's going to pull blood in there. But if its heart's beating, it can actually keep that blood going. So depending on the animal's behavior, its physiology, you know, locomotion and all that good stuff. You can see these valves related to that. So that's really neat. You've probably seen, if you have, you know, it's really cool to do this with little kids again. You have veins on your hand, right? That you can see, most of you can probably see those. Well, it's kind of cool that you can actually push on that vein right there. And if you hold your hand down, you know, it pops up more. You can see those popping up kind of. You can push right there, and you can actually push the blood up the vein, and you can see the vein collapse. And if you see it collapse, it's completely collapsed. But then you can push back like that, and you can actually see where the valves are. That's pretty cool, right? So that's kind of fun. You can actually, if you're bored, you know, studying, put your hand down and find out where your valves are on your blood vessels in your hand. Kind of neat, all right? And if you have varicose veins in your legs, then you could try that too, and you can find where your valves are. And sometimes you can see it pretty well because the blood's not going past that, and it kind of pools at that spot until you move your leg, and then you see it move through. So kind of cool, right? More fun things to do. All right, so we already talked about the valves, and we talked about these names, tricuspid, bicuspid, but also, you know, we call them AV valves, right? And we call the semilunar valves up to the aorta or the pulmonary artery. So try to get your head around these different names, too, and knowing where these valves are. So it's called tricuspid because it looks like three flaps here. Okay, and these we showed you when we went to the outreach center, these little papillary muscles right here with these corded tendon that actually help hold the valves from not going the opposite direction, because otherwise if it's just contracted, it could push those valves back into the aorta. So think if you had a little coronary blockage to the tissue right here, and that papillary muscle wasn't healthy, right? Then this could die, this could break loose, and then what's going to happen to the blood flow? It's going to go back into the aorta. I mean, back into the atrium, sorry. Back into the atrium. So you get that swishing effects, right? And we're going to talk about some sounds here in a little bit. Okay, so know the general anatomy of the mammalian heart, and then the general points that we just talked about, like a fish, atria, a ventricle, two-chambered heart. Then we'll get to amphibians that have a three-chambered heart, like two atrium, one ventricle, like a frog. Okay? Okay, so we just talked about those. We talked about some of this before a long time ago, but the main point, and I know there's more text on here than needs to be, but for your studying purposes, this would be good. In the heart, you have gap junctions. And these gap junctions allow electrical flow from cell to cell, right? And so you have specialized heart tissue for your electrical flow from your electrical conduction, but also those cells connected to each other, so you have electrical flow so you can depolarize the neighboring cell.
So what happens if the valves are not functioning and there is a
vacuum? Yep, you will hear, if you were listening to the, like a stethoscope, you could hear, you know, normally what is it? Left up, right? Anybody ever see Jaws? Worth listening just to see it for that scary part. And that heart rate actually added so much to the scariness, because when you hear the heart, it's kind of scary, right? Love dub, love dub, love dub. What if it was the love dub, swoosh, love swoosh, love swoosh, love dub, swoosh. You know, those are the kind of things that you would hear, and then you automatically, oh, what could be the problem? And we'll go through this on an online site here in a minute, too. So you have to think about, and we're going to go through the cardiac cycle, and then you will have it down pat. If you heard that sound, or if you read love, swish, dub, you would be able to select, is that A, B, or C? Hint, you get it? You know? Okay. So we want to go through that. On the cardiac muscle, so gap junctions compared to skeletal muscle, right? Cardiac tissue has gap junctions. Where does the calcium come from? Primarily in cardiac, or two places? SRN, extracellular, ECF, right? Extracellular foot. Skeletal muscle in mammals from the SR. In invertebrates, arthropods, calcium, the skeletal muscle can come from extracellular as well as SR, but it depends on the invertebrate, like a Drosophila larvae, mostly extracellular, because they don't need the SR because it's not that thick of a muscle fiber. So kind of put all that together. Cardiac muscle is really quite neat. It's still, you see the nice arrangements, the sarcomeres, but the muscles, not the myofibrils, aren't all lined up, right?
they have this kind of weaving in and out, really quite interesting the way the heart muscle works. There's a whole center of muscle biology here where they actually work with cardiac muscle and actually try to understand defects in myosin-actin interaction or electrical events or an arrangement of the heart. Okay, so the main points. Gap junctions, intercalculated discs, these desmosomes that keep the tissue together, tight connections. All right. And neurogenic versus myogenic hearts. You're a wonderful animal, neurogenic. Crustaceans. If you cut the nerves to the heart will stop beating. It will not beat. So many of the arthropods have neurogenic hearts, not all of them, and it might even depend on the developmental stage. Like crustaceans, and I don't want you to have to worry about all the little nitpicking things, but when like the crayfish is a juvenile, it's actually myogenic. Then later the nerves innervate, it becomes neurogenic, and if you cut the nerves, it can't beat anymore. So it's a developmental aspect as well. But kind of interesting to think about crustaceans. Neurogenics means it has to have a nervous system. Some of the Drosophila parts in insects can be myogenic as well, and that means it just beats by itself. You can cut the nerves out, and it doesn't need the nerves. You don't need the nerves, which is great, because you can have a heart transplant, right? You can cut the heart out and transplant it to someone else. You don't need the nerves. You don't even need the pacemaker. It will beat on its own, right? So you've probably seen those old horror movies where they pull the heart out of somebody and it's beating, right? Grossly. But it really would beat out of the animal. Okay, so why do we have these myogenic hearts? Well, think about these modified cells, these modified cardiac cells have their own pacemaker activity. Now, how can you have a pacemaker activity? That means ion flows at different times, different. And then how do you speed it up? How do you slow it down? Well, it's all by ion channels. Okay, so we can go through a little bit of this. And you can think of these kind of aspects. These are there's different views on this. This is not completely 100% solved. There's still questions about actually how these ions move and these channels open and close to give rise to the cardiac pacemaker potential. Isn't that wild? There's a guy over here in biomedical engineering. I'm forgetting his name now. But he's really good. He actually does computational programs to work on the ion channels, which ones are opening, how much conductance is going through there, why the other one opens. And he actually does the experiments and uses drugs on the heart to actually see that you could block that channel, what will happen to the pacemaker activity, put it into the computer program, and then come back and see how that works. So if you look at biomedical engineering, he actually takes undergraduates in the labs, but he usually says, he wants you to have Cal 1, 2, and 3 to work in his lab because he does a lot of calculus-based programming. But it's really quite cool what he's doing. He usually is very well funded. So the idea is that there's some interesting channels, and this is a little bit different from what we've heard before when we talk about the nervous system. So I just want you to be aware of these. There's a sodium channel that has an F next to it. It's called a funny sodium channel. Because it's funny, it doesn't work like the normal sodium channels that you're familiar with. When it depolarizes, that would open up. These actually open up when the cell hyperpolarizes. That's why it's funny. It's not like trick people, So it's a funny channel. There's actually an increased sodium conductance when it's hyperpolarized. So that's kind of interesting, because if it's hyperpolarized and you open up sodium channels, which way is the sodium going to go? Into the cell, and what's it going to do to the cell membrane?
Depolarize.
You see how that is kind of neat, right? So it depolarizes it, and then if you depolarize it, what other channels might open up? Voltage-gated calcium channels, or maybe voltage-gated sodium channels, a normal type, right? So then you can get, more depolarization. More depolarization. And then if you depolarize so much, now think about those potassium channels that we're familiar with, right? That are voltage-sensitive, but they open up at a higher voltage. So if you open up those, which way is potassium going to go? Out, and what's that going to tend to do to the membrane potentially? Bring it back down. But if you opened up another type of voltage-gated channel, a voltage-gated calcium channel, which way does calcium go? Calcium's high on the outside, it's going to go in, 2+. What's that going to do to the plasma membrane potential? 2+ coming in to the cell. It's going to maintain that depolarization. So it maintains that depolarization. So this is why the cardiac potentials can vary in duration, too, and it depends where we're talking about in the heart. So the width of this potential is dependent on the calcium that comes in, how many potassium channels open, how much potassium is going out of the cell, how much calcium is coming in. You can make that longer, you can make it shorter, and we're going to see that different tissues in the heart have different shape and action potentials based on the distribution and types of ion channels. Okay? So the take-home here is distribution and types of ion channels change the shape of the action potential, and throughout the heart, depends on the tissue in the heart, you're going to see different distributions of these types of channels, and the action potential changes its shape. And there is this funny sodium channel, and people who are in physiology department actually work with this. They patch clamp that, they work with it to try to understand how that channel works, because there's some pathologies related to these channels. Okay. So we'll go through this conduction pathway. We need to know that stuff. And if you're allied health or interested in any health profession, you should know how your heart is working, right? And heart. SA node, sinoatrial node, that is up in the right-hand side of your heart, like over your right atrium area. And then it sends out, like little branches, if you will, electrical conduction pathways that go across the atrium. So SA node, sinoatrial, so you can remember this. And it helps depolarize the atria in your heart. So they will contract. But after they contract, what do you want after that? You want that atrial contraction to push blood in the ventricles, but you don't want the ventricles to contract right away. You want them to fill up first, right? So the atria contract. Now electrical flow can go fast, right? Speed of electricity, right? Through gap junctions, really fast. So you don't want to go too fast. So it goes to the SA node. Now, the sinoatrial, what did I just do? I just confused you all. Yes, so sinoatrial node first. Sorry, I knew I was going to come to this. Sinoatrial node first, right? Sinoatrial node first. That goes to the atrial muscles. So, correction there. Okay, sinoatrial node to the atria, contracts the atria. Then it goes to the AV node, and atrioventricular node, atria to ventricle. So right there at the base of the atria where the septum starts. That actually, those cells slow down. Normally, they slow down the electrical potential. That's really wild. They can actually slow down the electrical signal. So it actually has a delay in the SA node. And then it goes down the ventricle, which is called the bundle of His for these modified types of electrical flow, the bundle of His, H-I-S. And then it goes through the what they call Purkinje cells, which are Purkinje type, it's not Purkinje neurons, which you might have heard of in other classes that are in your cerebellum. These are Purkinje fibers. They then go down into the heart, the ventricular muscle, and then that ventricle muscle depolarizes and then contracts. So we need to know this kind of flow, all right? And so we're going to go through this. And so here we go. I should have showed this first. SA, atrial contraction, slowing of the electrical event in the AV node. There's actually a special type of channels there. Slow it down a little bit, down the bundle of His, then the Purkinje fibers, and then to the heart. If you block the electrical flow from the SA to the AV node, which is really interesting, the AV node can take over. It has its own pacemaker activity. If you block the AV node to the bundle of His will have a pacemaker activity. If you block the bundle of His, the Purkinje fibers have their own pacemaker activity. Isn't that wild? But what would happen? So these are called blocks. What would happen if we block, let's just say, the fibers from the SA node to the AV node? That means the SA node is going to have its own activity, right? And the AV node is going to have its own activity. But they're not going to be in sync. So it's not going to prime the heart correctly, right? And then you're not going to have the right filling, and your cardiac output is going to go down.
Are the AV and SA both innervated by the same parasympathetic?
No. So that's a good question. We're coming up to that a little bit. The parasympathetic, the 10th cranial nerve, or the vagal nerve, right? The 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, it actually is mostly on the SA node. On the SA node. And what's the transmitter it's going to release? Parasympathetic, postganglionic, on the SA node. Acetylcholine. So it can be confusing. What's it doing to the heart? It's actually slowing it down. But acetylcholine on your skeleton muscles does what? Causes it to depolarize and contract. This is where the confusion comes in every year. Like, I thought it was, you know, caused the heart to contract more. No. on the heart, the acetylcholine parasympathetic slows the heart down, right? So parasympathetic releasing acetylcholine, mostly on the SA node. Now, what's really interesting is then the sympathetic is kind of innervating pretty much. It has fibers all over the heart, pretty much. So that's a little different. So the sympathetic is kind of on top of the heart, but it can also speed up the pacemaker potential. Okay, so it can actually enhance what they call inotropic. Inotropic is the strength of contraction. It has inotropic properties, the strength of contraction, and chronotropic properties, chrono, time. It can speed up the time as well. So sympathetic, chronotropic, and inotropic. Speeds up the rate as well as speeds up the strength of contraction. Okay. So if you have these blocks, then you can have differences. You can pick that up in the EKG trace. You can pick that up by sound. You can probably, it's really severe, some other problems that will happen. So what's your normal pacemaker activity? Your SA node, how fast is your heart beating normally? Besides when you get your exam. 120 beats a minute, 80 beats a minute, 70 beats a minute, 10 beats a minute. 70, right? Usually around 70 beats a minute at rest state for an adult. Okay, so 70 beats a minute. So what's controlling that? The SA node, right? The SA node. If you block the SA node, let's damage the SA node, the AV node takes over. Under normal conditions, what's its rate? Maybe 60 to 70, or 55 to 70, depends on the person, okay? You block that, what's the bundle of His rate? Maybe 40 beats a minute. You block the bundle of His, what's the Purkinje rate that can be? Maybe about 20 to 30 beats a minute. So you get the idea. They're all slower, but the master pacemaker is the SA node. Something else that's interesting is, like when you asked that question about the parasympathetic, what if you had a strong parasympathetic innervation to the heart and you dumped a bunch of acetylcholine on it? Could it stop the heart? Anybody look that up when you were doing the writing? There's actually a term called vagal escape. So vagal escape is that not all the cells around the SA node are innervated by the vagal nerve. And the reason is so you won't stop the heart. That's what people think about. So it's called vagal escape, that not all the SA cells around there have acetylcholine receptors. So it won't be completely stopping the heart, right, if you stimulate the vagal nerve. Okay, so how do you change and how do you regulate blood pressure? Well, you know, where do you have, how do we remember this? What does pH in your body versus blood pressure? Hint, hint, something here, right? Not the jugular vein, the artery, the carotid artery, right? Carotid bodies, the bodies, and carotid, MCAT type of questions, carotid, anybody help me out? Carotid bodies, carotid, what? And you have a head cold, a stuffed up head cold. What's blocked? Your sinuses, right? This is like a Jeopardy thing. So carotid sinuses, carotid bodies. So when you have a head cold, you have sinus pressure, right? It feels, you know, miserable. So think about pressure in your sinuses. Pressure, carotid sinuses detect the pressure. Carotid bodies are for pH, CO2 monitoring. So you have carotid sinuses here. So what happens if you, this is why, you know, kids messing around and putting an arm hold around each other, you can actually be pushing on those carotid sinuses and actually stimulating them and causing a problem. So what's the carotid sinus going to detect? High pressure, right? And so what's that going to do? Goes to the brain. Those are neurons around the carotid sinuses. They detect that stretch, right? They send electrical activities to the brain. The brain then activates what? If it's too high a pressure, do you want to activate the sympathetic system? Want to activate the parasympathetic system? Yes. Right? So now it'll slow down the heart. Right? And so you activate the parasympathetic system, and you slow down the heart, and then your pressure goes down. It's like a negative feedback process. There was a case a number of years back, and I don't know if I already told you the story. It was in China. It was like 6 years ago or so. Right on their honeymoon, they started necking, and the new wife, necking, kissing on the neck,
generation gap or something. So necking, and then stimulated the, they think stimulated the carotid sinuses so much, the wife actually died on her honeymoon. Because she didn't have, she was very sensitive to the carotid sinus pressure. And so some people are very sensitive to that, rubbing on the carotid sinuses, and can actually slow down your heart. And if you were exercising or something, then it could actually cause your heart not to work well, and then you could not. So that could, you know, it's a problem with the carotid sinuses. Okay, so something to think about. There was some, oh yeah, I remember that when that came out. No, that came out what year? My daughter was a sophomore in high school, and I had to tell her that story. So kind of scared her. All right, so anyways, I don't know if it worked or not, but we'll see. Hopefully. Okay, so go through this. And, you know, so the electrical activity, like I said, these are modified for electrical conduction through here. It's not just going, you know, over the heart this way and traveling down. This is going to be different than, you know, for the flow of electricity around the atrium to the ventricle muscle. Even though the atrial depolarizes, it's not going down into the ventricle and causing contraction. It has to go down the spondyl of his, the Purkinje fibers, and then depolarize. Okay, so you can kind of go through what we already said up there, but I did mentioned that there's different types of action potentials on the heart. If you go down to the ventricular muscles, what do you want to do with the ventricular muscles? You want them to contract a long time to get the blood out. So how can you do that? Have a long action potential. So notice the duration here. 250 milliseconds. What's the duration of a normal action potential? About a millisecond, 2 milliseconds in the nervous system, right? This is 250 milliseconds. That is really long, right? So why is it so long? So to get a lot of calcium into the ventricular muscles so you have a strong contraction. And how does this happen? That plateau, standardized time for test questions on MCAS, is that plateau is due to calcium entry into the cell. It's into the cell that keeps it depolarized. That plateau is due to calcium entry. Okay, and that's the main points there. Now we can go through a little diagram here that might help. I pulled it up online here. Let me see if I can do this thing. It's on your web page. The schematic that I made up there to kind of go through steps, this is also thought to actually help with pacemaker activity. So if you drew... We've got just a few minutes. Let's try this out. I'll try to draw it here just to kind of put it. But it's all on the text there. So if you had a cell and you had ER inside, or SER, you get a little bit of this calcium leak, let I say right here. So there's a continual increasing and decreasing of calcium. So think about the diastolic is heart at rest. Systolic is when the heart's contracting. So at diastolic time, you have a little release of calcium into the cell. So if you get this little release of calcium that's in the cell, okay, a little release of calcium into the cell, then what's going to happen to that cell? So you get a little bit of release of calcium. Oops, sorry. I should draw this from the ER through the ranadine receptor. So this is the ranadine receptor. I'll just write RY. This calcium's kind of leaking out. So you can start leak, and you can put a number to it. The calcium's going to leak. Well, what's going to happen with that calcium leak? How does the calcium get out of the cells? How do you think about the neurons, right, the nerve terminal? You got to buffer that calcium. You got to get it back out into rest. So there's always a system going on. And one of the systems is the sodium-calcium exchange. So calcium goes out. Sodium goes in. This is the exchanger, the NCX, sodium-calcium exchanger. Well, if sodium comes in, what does that do? That can actually depolarize the cell. So these are some of the ideas that are out there. And as I said, not everything is, you know, black and white completely yet, but this is some of the ideas in some textbooks. So the sodium then comes in, and this can actually cause the cell to be somewhat depolarized. So then you open up, and you can actually get more sodium in, more voltage-gated sodium channels, for example. That could depolarize the cell even more. What could that happen then? Then you could have calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels to open. Now you raise the calcium up a bit. So a bit. All right. So now you can go through 1, 2, 3, 4. And with a little bit of raise of calcium, just a bit, go 5, that can actually cause more calcium to be released from the ER, the SER. So it's called calcium-induced calcium release. So calcium-induced calcium release, or CIRCA. So then that calcium, more calcium comes out. So now you have more calcium to come out. So that would be number six. So this is going to raise calcium. Let's put two arrows there. That's going to raise calcium a lot more in the cytoplasm. But what's really interesting about ranitidine receptors, they leak generally when calcium's low. But when calcium is high, this high calcium, so where are we? We're at seven now. This high calcium can actually go back on the ranitidine receptor and inhibit it. So eight. So we can put an inhibition. So if you inhibit the ranitidine receptor from releasing calcium, then what's going to happen? Calcium is going to go down. And you start the whole process all over again. So I know that's a little confusing, but if you work it out, it's kind of interesting in the way calcium is regulated, this kind of yin-yang type of effect, right? So this is the relationship with calcium inside that can go up and down and can actually then alter how that cell is going to respond to the calcium. So we put that in there. There's a reference to this, too, if you want some more information. But generally, this is kind of interesting. Okay, so we don't have any more time. I'm behind. So on Monday and on Wednesday, we will probably do more cardiac systems, and I'll try to finish up on the cardiac in the lab. And then where we left off in the lab, we'll pick up and lecture on Tuesday. But then on Wednesday lab, we'll go back and kind of pick up where we went on a Monday lab. So I know it's going to be a little disjunct. But what are we going to do this weekend? Study, study, study. Things from the last exam, right? And this cardiac stuff. The cardiac's not so bad. Most of the bad stuff is really, the harder stuff is the endocrine chapter, endocrine content, right?
Is all the perception and sensory stuff on this exam too as well?
Yes. Yeah. And that's kind of, and that's some of that's not too hard. And skeletal muscle, right?
Okay.
Sensory, the end of the sensory behavior. Skeletal muscle, endocrine, cardiac, everything involved. But where people have the most difficulty is endocrine. Okay.
Oh, the most of it is endocrine?
I mean, where people have the most difficulty is endocrine, right? Okay.
But it's going to be split, like, relatively.
Well, there's not a lot on the behavior, and it's kind of cheap, busy kind of stuff. Hey, how's it going? Don't yawn, you put me to sleep.
Do I know it? I'm really scared of it. Good time for y'all. No, my question, are you going to be going over?